come like that edgy girl in college, all wild hacked hair and leather, who showed up at the reunion with a blow-dried bob and a little black dress, her nose piercing closed up as though it had never existed. All this had made the future seem impossibly out of reach for the young. During the summer, she and Rachel had driven to a spa in Massachusetts for massages and nature hikes, and that night, she had let Rachel have a glass of wine with dinner. It had loosened the floodgates of late adolescence. "Sometimes I'm really, really afraid," her daughter said, her cheeks pink from either the rejuvenating facial or the Chardonnay. "Oh, honey, of what?" Nora asked. "Of not succeeding and not making you and Daddy proud of me," she said, her eyes filling. "We're proud of you no matter what you do." "Mom, honestly, I hate it when you say that. It's like those trophies everybody used to get at day camp for just showing up. You don't want someone to be proud of you for nothing. You want them to be proud of you for actually doing something to be proud of." Next morning, Rachel had been her usual self, making faces all through bar class and insisting that having her armpits waxed had to be more painful than natural childbirth. "If I have kids, I'm taking the drugs," Rachel said. "It's a labor of love," Nora said. "Spare me," said Rachel, but she leaned in and kissed her mother as she said it. Nora's walk to work was a kind of labor of love, too, of that love for the city that occasionally wavered or dimmed but had never gone away. She tended to see always the same people, the Sikh bicyclist with his two small children and a seat on the back, the man who ran while nonchalantly juggling three fluorescent green tennis balls. It was as though they all knew one another without knowing anything about one another, so that if for a week or two Tennis Ball Man did not appear, Nora would find herself wondering if he was on vacation or had moved to another neighborhood or something worse, a broken hip, a heart attack. Change was the leitmotif of New York, and yet there was an unvarying fabric for most New Yorkers. At the halfway point of her walk, Nora almost always passed the old woman who threw pieces of baguette into the water for the geese and the gulls. Sometimes she wondered about the genesis of those baguettes, perhaps delivered too late for the restaurant's dinner rush because of traffic, cannibalized in part for croutons and bread pudding, the rest junked in the dumpster and rescued by the old woman and loaded into the wire cart she always pushed. Or maybe, Nora thought, the woman was someone with a nice pension and no relations, who spent all her disposable income on bread for birds. Nora said good morning to her every day. The woman always ignored her. She loved this part of her day, even in the worst weather, when the wind, abetted by the open runway of the river, ripped at the spokes of her umbrella and rattled the nylon overhead. Even with the pale scrim of snowfall or fog, she could see the skyline of the New Jersey towns, what always seemed like a half-hearted attempt to echo their triumphant cousin across the Hudson. Charlie tolerated New York City, but was prone to spreading his arms and crooning, "Ah, smell that air," when he found himself anywhere from her father's house in Connecticut to an inn in the Tuscan countryside. Nora liked those places, but her relationship to the city was primal and chemical. There was a great immutability to the Hudson River, broad and gray and dappled like moir taffeta, and a certain democracy to those she passed going to and fro, who in workout clothes or the coat thrown on to walk the schnauzer could be schoolteacher or CEO. Occasionally, she passed the walk-up building where she had lived for 2 years after college, sharing a one-bedroom. She and Jenny had flipped a coin to see who would sleep on the living room futon, and Nora had lost. Actually, Jenny scarcely needed the bedroom since there were many nights when she did not come home, and Nora lay awake wondering how long she should wait before calling the police. Then, just after dawn, with mascaraed raccoon eyes and pantyhose in her purse, Jenny would tiptoe through to the kitchen and coffee. She was getting her doctorate at Columbia then, and stayed on to teach there, although when the time came, she was almost denied tenure. She'd expanded her thesis on matriarchal societies into a popular book that had gotten a lot of attention and landed Jenny on several television interview shows, which worked perfectly because she looked like an actress playing a young and beautiful anthropologist, all curly hair and big eyes and bohemian clothing. This led the chair of the department to refer to her as a popular academic, with the word popular used as a pejorative. But 2 weeks later, the chair of the department had died of a stroke, and the week after that, the provost's wife invited Jenny to speak to her book club, which was convenient because all its members were the wives of administrators or professors. There were no other women in the anthropology department, and the university was being investigated for gender bias, and Jenny got tenure and then later an endowed chair. "Just a series of lucky breaks," she always said with a grin, "especially that stroke." Every once in a while, when she had a meeting, Nora would pass the narrow windows of the bar at which she'd met Charlie. 14 Carrots, it was called now, with its vegan menu, but then it had been the Tattooed Lady. Nora hadn't wanted to go that night, she remembered. She'd had an unremarkable romantic life in the city compared to that of her other girlfriends, which was to say it hovered between pathetic and disastrous. She had arrived in the city still deeply in love with her ex-boyfriend from college, and had had the bad fortune, on an early date with a broker, who had been attractive and not at all obviously psycho, to see James at a table across the room, laughing, combing back his wavy dark hair with one hand in a gesture she knew as well as she knew the alphabet. Nora had wept over the creme brulee on the dessert menu, which had been their dessert, hers, and James's. "Who has a dessert?" Jenny said the next day. "A song, okay. A place, but a dessert? And the most boring dessert. Okay, maybe rice pudding is more boring. But Jesus, Nora, at least cry for lava cake." Of course, the broker had never called her again. Nora had lost track of all the ones who came after, and in retrospect, she blamed herself. Her great love affair had ended under such an improbable cloud that she was suspicious of virtually every man she encountered. Every first date was second-guessing. There had been what seemed like a really nice lawyer, who brought a picnic to Central Park and took her to the Cloisters, and who for several weeks she thought might be in it for the long haul. Then he disappeared, and her friend Jean Ann, also a lawyer, heard his name and mentioned that in her circle he was called the Phantom, because he wowed every woman he wooed and then vanished without a trace. And Nora's distrust only deepened. It was Jenny who had insisted she come to the Tattooed Lady. There was a TA at Columbia Jenny wanted Nora to meet, not, she assured her, for a real relationship, but for reliable sex. Jenny always liked to say that she didn't date, she slept with people. And once she had had a couple of glasses of wine, slept with was not the term she used. Earlier that day, she had helped Nora pick out her first leather jacket, and she made her wear it and wear her hair down, too. "What the hell with the ponytail, Nor?" she'd said, pulling the elastic loose. "You'll be losing your hair by the time you're 40. 40 had sounded then like another country, like they would need passports and language lessons to live there. The Columbia student was attractive in that peevish, elfin way that for some reason Jenny favored, and he wore ironic clothes, a vintage varsity jacket, brown and black saddle shoes. Charlie was his sort of friend from Bowdoin, who, the Columbia student made clear in a series of asides, he had had to bring along after they'd run into each other unexpectedly. The TA chatted with Jenny while sizing up Nora sidelong, his index finger held in front of his lips in a way that looked disapproving. But Charlie bought Nora a drink and told her about a case he was working on pro bono, a school that was being dispossessed by the church in which it held classes. He'd just come from the office, and he opened his briefcase to show her a drawing the first grade had made. "Thank you, Mr. Nolan, for helping our shul." "It's a Jewish school?" Nora said. But Charlie smoothed out the drawing with his hand and said, "No, they're kids. They can't spell. My name is Nolan, one L, no D." He had a Band-Aid on the bend of his arm, and when Nora asked about it, he pulled it off and balled it up and said, "I forgot all about that. Company blood drive." Charlie still gave blood once a year, maybe because Nora had said a couple of months after that night that the blood donation was one of the reasons she had given him her number. She couldn't tell him that after all the bright young men who had talked about themselves maniacally as she nodded, the ones who were well and truly pissed that she wouldn't sleep with them in exchange for Coco Van and Cabernet, were ones with whom she had slept, including the guy who had given her an STD she now had to mention on almost every damn medical form, even all these years later. After them all, Charlie, 1L, no D, Nolan, literal, guileless, all the things that would eventually make her sometimes want to scream, on that night, in this city, made her feel like that moment when you walk out of the waves, teeth chattering, goose flesh from shoulder to ankle, and someone wraps you in a towel. That towel is just a towel, ordinary, humdrum, but at that one moment, it feels like fur, better than fur, like safety, care, the right thing. Walking her back to the minute first-floor apartment into which she'd just moved, in a deeply unfashionable but not horribly dangerous neighborhood, Charlie had stopped at her corner and said, "You are great." When Rachel had rolled her eyes at the story, Charlie said it had never happened, but it had. "You are great." Of course, it now seemed forever ago. What had happened to all of them after they left behind those shabby little apartments with the DMZ of boric acid showing white at the borders of cabinets and closets to ward off the roaches? When Nora had first met him at that bar, Charlie had planned to practice environmental law, had instead been seconded to a junior partner in the corporate area, had traded in a job representing finance types for becoming one himself. Nora had meandered her way to something that might be called the top, she supposed, with her job at the museum. The identities of everyone they knew were illusory. They considered themselves New Yorkers, but all of them were from someplace else, and many of them had become people who loved to hate the city where they lived. But Nora had never stopped loving it. She still liked the sound of someone ranting on the street, someone screaming at a person who hadn't picked up after a dog, someone fighting over a parking space that two cars thought they had claimed with their blinkers, or someone simply spouting random crazy talk, although now, with cell phones, it was sometimes hard to tell. In the old days, a person speaking on the street was either a delusionary or an actor rehearsing for an audition. Now it could be someone taking a meeting through an earpiece. Nora still found it all oddly soothing, the idea that she was safe and warm and drinking a cup of tea and reading the New Yorker, and outside some woman was screaming at her boyfriend that he never, never paid attention to what she was telling him, which had made Nora want to throw open the window and yell, "Duh!" into the raw and rainy night. She liked that she could hear the woman and the woman could see the light in her window, and yet they were separate, unacquainted. But even loving New York as she did, Nora sometimes felt it was like loving an old friend, someone who had over the years become different from her former self. Of course, Nora and Charlie had become different too. It was as though, as the city had prospered and become less dirty, less funky, less hard and harsh, the Nolans and their friends had followed suit, all their rough edges and quirks sanded down into some New York standard of accomplishment. The price they had paid for prosperity was amnesia. They'd forgotten who they once had been. Nora sometimes thought that if, through some magic of the space-time continuum, which she didn't understand but had heard Oliver and his geeky friends discuss through an entire year of high school, she might run into her younger self on her walk some morning. The two of them would scarcely recognize each other. The old Nora would have contempt for the new. The former Nora would be buying a hot dog with the works at the hot dog place on the corner of Broadway near their house, an outpost of sanity in a $5 latte world. And the now Nora would trudge by after picking up a salad thinking of nitrates and acid reflux.
"The best hangover cure on earth is one of those hot dogs with cooked onions," Oliver had said his senior year in high school.
"Excuse me?" Nora said. "Wake up and smell the mustard, Mommy," Rachel had said. Every time Nora walked past the hot dog place, she remembered that, exercising the nitrates. Wake up and smell the mustard. Or the pickles outside the last old deli on the Lower East Side, an area that had improbably become cool, as had the deli. Or the gyros that marked the moment when she turned onto the block where the museum hunched over the narrow street. The gyros were sold from a truck that played tinny Greek music starting at 10 in the morning. Nora nodded at the guy at the truck window as she went by.
"Here she comes,"
called Phil, sitting cross-legged on the sidewalk. His sleeping bag was dirty brown, his t-shirt gray, his sign, black marker on tan cardboard. "Veteran, need something to eat. God bless you." The sky was as gray as his blanket. "They're predicting rain this afternoon," Nora said.
"The driver for the big boss told me," he said.
Bibi was the big boss. Nora was merely the boss. Nora couldn't complain to Charlie about the poop bags on the stoop because she knew he would once again talk about leaving the city, which had become his answer to everything from the clogged drain in the parking lot to the rise in real estate taxes to, she suspected, her meeting with Bob Harris.
"When you start your new job,"
he would say sourly sometimes, no matter how often she said she had no intention of leaving the one she had. Charlie clutched his grievances close. He remembered every co-op building at which the real estate person had been high-handed, every restaurant at which they'd sat at the bar for too long while others were led to a table. So Nora mentioned the poop bags only at her women's lunch. She should have known the others would be somewhat unsympathetic. All of them lived in apartment buildings with doormen who would make short work of anyone trying to leave a tissue on the sidewalk in front, much less a bag of dog leavings. "Not while we're eating, for Christ's sake," Elena said when Nora was talking, waving her hand in the air. "Do you know an architect named James Mortimer?" Suzanne asked Nora. "I'm decorating a house that he designed, and when I said one of my girlfriends had been at Williams, he said that you two were friends in college."
"We were,"
Nora said.
"What kind of friends?" Suzanne said.
"What's the house?" Nora said, instead of answering.
"What can I say?
A total nightmare. One of those hedge fund guys with a second wife bought 2 walk-up buildings downtown and had them raised to build something with 8 bedrooms, a green roof, and a lap pool. Aluminum."
"Why would anyone want an aluminum lap pool?" Jenny said.
"Not the lap pool, the house. Very modern, angular, the kind of thing that will wind up in some magazine. The wife was an art history major and thinks she knows what she's doing. The only thing that's keeping her under control is that I think she's crushing on your friend James. I just hope she doesn't sleep with him and blow the whole deal up. It's a good job for me in a lot of ways. It will get a lot of attention, and they don't care what anything costs. And working with James, I want a detailed explanation of how you're going to furnish this place," said Jenny, who had less interest in furniture than anyone Nora knew, but wanted Suzanne to natter on about grass cloth and glass tile instead of James Mortimer, which was exactly what happened. As they walked out together, Jenny muttered, "Jesus, this city is like Mayberry. Everyone knows everyone else, especially the people you don't want them to know, especially James goddamn Mortimer."
"It's fine, Jen," Nora said. "How's Jasper?"
"Good. He's auditing one of my classes."
"Really?"
"The one on fertility and pregnancy in various cultures. He doesn't have time to come to class, but he does all the readings and says he even wants to do the paper. Can you imagine a sure way to kill a relationship? Sorry, babe, but this is a B-minus at best."
"Are you actually in a relationship?"
"I think maybe I am."
"Isn't that weird?
What about you? You seem a little fried."
"I'm fine. I just wish someone would stop leaving poop bags in front of my house."
"That's weird and creepy. And I say that as someone who has never owned a dog. Is that the right term? Do we still own dogs, or is that, I don't know, speciesist? And if I can't say you own a dog anymore, does that mean we're all officially insane?"
"We are, aren't we? Totally insane.
I used to be a radical feminist, and the other day one of my students dismissed me as a straight establishment woman."
"Sometimes I think Homer owns us," Nora said. "I don't think we'd even live where we live if it wasn't for Homer."
It was true. In a way, Homer was responsible for their life on the block. His arrival had dovetailed with the period when Charlie had believed that he was on the verge of becoming, pick one, depending on degree of intoxication, a Top Gun, a Macher, a Rainmaker, a big swinging dick. They were living in a nice enough 3-bedroom apartment, and with a big bump in the real estate market, their equity and their place had doubled. Add a boom year bonus, and Charlie became obsessed with the idea that they should have a place more conducive to parties, dinners. He'd actually used the word entertaining 2 or 3 times.
But virtually all of the co-ops they looked at had a no-dog policy, and eventually their real estate agent had taken them to see the house. "No board approval, no financials," she said to Charlie, as though they might be drug dealers. But the long vista of the second-floor double parlor answered Charlie's vision of successful cocktail parties. They had had a party the second year they'd lived there, and the wife of a partner at a law firm, with whom Charlie did a lot of business at the time, looked around with a glass of wine in her hand and said with a sigh, "I've always wanted to live in a house exactly like this." Charlie had expanded before Nora's eyes, as though the woman had attached a bicycle pump and 1, 2, 3 created a chestier, prouder, bigger man. While Nora's ambition was a thing so ephemeral as to be nearly non-existent, Charlie had had a strong sense of what he wanted, although Nora thought life would have been simpler if his goal had had a title, judge, senior partner. Instead, Nora had realized early on that he simply wanted to be somebody. Charlie's father, an accountant who did the taxes of the locals in their smallish upstate town out of a basement home office with a separate side entrance, had an older brother who managed a steel processing plant, a towering figure among the Nolans, discussed as though he were a hair's breadth from great wealth and stature. Charlie had realized that Uncle Glenn's life and not making an April 15 filing deadline for the principal of the high school and the chief of police was what was desirable. Nora had met Uncle Glenn exactly twice, once at her wedding, another time at a family reunion. It was considered a great coup that Glenn, who was so very busy, had managed to travel from Pittsburgh to Albany. After his third vodka gimlet, he had told Nora that he had always wanted to be a writer, but that, events being what they were, he had been obliged to major in business in college. "And, well," he added with the kabuki modesty that his extended family frequently lauded, "it all turned out for the best." Nora always suspected that his position was less than described, although enough for European vacations and a new Cadillac every 3 years, which at the time were definite markers of prosperity, along with a mink coat for the wife. But his legend was deep in her husband's DNA. Nora wondered if that was one of the things Charlie had come to like about the block, that on the block, he was known, valued, somebody. Nora had liked it there right from the beginning. Homer was young when they first moved in, and more tolerant of strangers, and walking him, Nora met most of the neighbors. The Fisks had had the Mastiff before the Rottweiler. The Fenstermachers had a standard poodle, a redhead called Elizabeth II, not after the Queen, it emerged, but after Elizabeth I, who had herself been preceded by Charles. George had what he always described as a rescue pug, as though he were the champion of small, bug-eyed dogs everywhere. He often had 2 or 3. They would dance around Homer on their pinpoint feet, wheezing and growling, while Homer looked out into the middle distance, his ice-blue eyes unfocused, as though thinking, "What are these things, and why do they think I should acknowledge them?" Homer was an Australian cattle dog, mottled and spade-faced with a solid body and stance that telegraphed what he was, a working dog with no nonsense about him. Rachel started to whine about a dog from first grade, when it seemed every playdate and duplex apartment came with a Labrador. "That's all we need," Charlie used to say, as though dog ownership were like a second mortgage or bankruptcy. Then he'd blown it at a barbecue in Pound Ridge given by one of the senior partners. The man's wife bred dogs. "And looks every inch of it," said Nora in the car, although the woman had been perfectly nice in that bluff, collegial, wasp way, and Charlie had looked down at the cattle dog peering up into his face with an intelligent gaze, the dog seeing in Charlie's thick fingers an hors d'oeuvre possibly dropping, and said to his host, "Now, if we were talking about a dog like this, I would get a dog in a heartbeat." Charlie had not noticed that Rachel was behind him, with the same glittery look in her eyes that Nora saw in people at the newsstand who were buying lottery tickets. That was how they came to arrive home from Westchester County 6 months later with a piglet of a puppy. Nora had been surprised at how attached she became to Homer. Even when he needed to pee at the curb on a cold night, a little puddle that turned into yellow ice. Charity had been unpersuaded about Homer when he had first appeared, unpersuaded as well that Rachel and Oliver truly intended to take care of the dog in the way they both insisted they would. In this, of course, Charity was wise, as she was in all else.
"Lot of mess,"
she kept repeating as the puppy piddled on the parquet.
"Oh, lot of mess."
"You've been to Jamaica," Jenny said on one of their phone calls. "Dogs aren't pets there. They're feral animals who roam the streets." So it had come as something of a surprise when Homer had become as singular and triumphant a figure in the Charity narrative as the twins had always been. Homer had found and killed a rat in the park. Perhaps true, although Nora couldn't think of it without shuddering, Homer had leapt into the air and snagged a pigeon. Sounded apocryphal, was actually accurate, as Nora discovered when she picked up a poop full of feathers the next day. Homer was an object of desire for a professional football player in one of the high-rises, who had offered thousands of dollars to buy him. Almost certainly embellished, although there was a pro player living in one of the nearby buildings.
"If she says that Homer dragged a couple of kids out of a burning building, are you going to keep agreeing with her?"
Charlie asked one morning when Charity had insisted that it had not been Homer who had taken the block of cheddar from the counter.
"Why did that man leave cheese out?"
she asked Nora later. Charlie usually being referred to in the vaguest possible terms. When she had first interviewed Charity, Nora had asked if she was married.
"Who wants that mess?"
Charity had said with a snort.
"If it makes Charity happy," she'd said.
Charity, too, remained insensible of the bags being left on their stoop. One morning at the corner, Nora had confided in Linda Lessman.
"That feels like such a hostile gesture," Linda said. "If someone was doing that to me, I'd be tempted to let the court officers know."
"Thank you. That's just how I feel. It's not about litter. It's a message, right?" Nora looked at the aged panel van double parked up the street. "I'm going to ask Ricky if he's seen anyone," she said. That morning, Nora had come out of the house and stepped right into an encounter between a traffic enforcement agent and one of Ricky's guys, whose English didn't extend to much beyond,
"Senora, no, senora."
"Don't senora me," the agent, a broad-shouldered woman who was wielding a pen like a deadly weapon over a pad of tickets, replied. Ricky came running down the block, waving his arms.
"Oh, please no,"
he cried, looking from the double-parked van to the agent, who had the look of concentration on her face you usually saw in teenagers working on an essay in AP English. It was well known throughout New York that once the tip of a traffic agent's pen had so much as touched the surface of the paper, there was no going back. Jack Fisk's favorite line was, "I know the mayor." It never worked. Ricky had always been one of those skinny, ropey guys who never gained a pound, but his pants hung loose now, and it looked as though he was losing weight. Nora was sad to see it because she had once seen a different Enrique Ramos, the one they didn't know on the block. She'd met him several months before when it turned out the dishwasher wouldn't drain, no matter how much she bailed water, and she'd been reduced to using the apple corer to try to unplug the downspout. Twice, she asked Charity to get Ricky, and finally Charity said,
"No one sees that man this week. His little boy is terrible sick."
Nora dropped the corer into the murky gray soup at the bottom of the dishwasher. "How sick?"
"That thing, what you call it, Ali had."
And here Charity made a sound as though she were trying to eject her own lungs. "Croup?" Nora said.
"That one,"
Charity said. "Tell me when you see him and I'll give them my humidifier. That made a big difference. It's down in the basement, isn't it?"
"Upstairs. Rachel use it sometime to open her paws. That kind of nonsense."
But Ricky had not appeared, and Nora decided to take the humidifier to him. It was too unwieldy to take on the subway.
"The man can buy his own humidifier, the prices he charges," said Charlie on his way into the office on a Saturday morning, apparently because some deal was falling apart.
Nora still remembered that day as a disaster in every way possible. She had had a hard time getting the car out of the narrow opening to the lot, and had to be directed out by George, who was pleased as could be to have the opportunity to condescend. Then she had misread the signs, taken the George Washington Bridge into New Jersey, and found it hard to find a place to turn and head back in the right direction. Construction in the Bronx had closed the exit her directions had given her,
and the Indian man she asked at the gas station kept nodding and smiling, repeating, "Grand Concourse," until she realized she was actually on the road she had been trying desperately to find. She slid into a parking space in front of a bodega and locked the car while two teenagers, with 3 inches of boxer shorts above the waistband of their jeans, stared at the 2 feet between her car and the curb. She heard them laughing as she carried the humidifier in her arms. It was heavy. In front of her, a man strode down the street, greeting the old people who sat in the shafts cut into the front of the apartment buildings, getting as much light and air as there was to be found on a side street in the South Bronx. A kid leaned out a window and called something to the man, and he waved but walked on. He was wearing a leather jacket and snug jeans, and there was a swivel in his walk, like he was hearing music in his head the way Nora often did during her walk to work, although she was certain she had never moved quite like that. 4 older men were playing dominoes around a card table on the sidewalk, hunched in coats that were too heavy for the weather. They raised leathery hands to the younger man as he walked by. Nora said, 12:14, to a woman in a wheelchair with a New York Yankees blanket over her legs. The woman pointed at the man. "Follow him," she said. Nora passed a sign in the next building that said, "No loitering. Violators will be prosecuted." The man in front of her bent down to pick up an empty beer can from the sidewalk and flipped it into a trash can at the curb. It wasn't until she got to the steps of the last building on the block that he turned, and she realized it was Ricky. But a different Ricky. A Ricky at home, in his zone, not in uniform, not in character, or perhaps in his real character. A lighter, brighter cousin to the Ricky she knew, almost unrecognizable until he saw Nora Nolan standing behind him. The way his face changed made Nora sad, as though just by showing up she'd turned this buoyant character into the leaden facsimile he took downtown each day for work.
"Mrs., what are you doing here?"
he said, taking the box out of her arms. "I'm sorry," Nora said, only in that moment realizing to her dismay that there were lines between people as clear as the median on Park Avenue or the narrower one she'd almost run over on the Grand Concourse, and that you were supposed to respect them.
"No, no," Ricky said. "No problem."
But it was. It was a problem. "I heard your boy had the croup, and Oliver had the croup when he was 5. It was just awful, that sound of him coughing. I remember staying up all night with him in the bathroom with the shower running for an hour so the steam would fill the room. It was the only thing that helped, and then the pediatrician said, get a good humidifier, a good one, not one of those cheap ones from Duane Reade, and we set it up in the room, and I'm pretty sure that's what got him over the hump, the steam, all night long, so that all that stuff in his chest got loosened up."
"Rico!" yelled a voice from above them. "What the hell?"
A woman was leaning out of a window. Her arms were folded on the sill, and she was hunched over them so that she had stupendous cleavage. Her mouth was as tight as her eyes were hot.
"This is Mrs. Nolan,"
Ricky said. "Nora," Nora called, waving. "You must be Nita. I've heard so much about you." Charity had told her that Nita was a home health aide, moving from elderly person to elderly person in the Bronx as each one died. Looking up at her flamethrower of an expression, Nora wondered if she helped kill them.
"You're taking your sweet time," Nita said.
"I brought a humidifier," Nora said. "My son had the croup. It really helped."
"Thank you,"
Ricky said.
"You deaf, Rico?"
Nita shouted. "I have to go," said Nora.
"That humidifier really helped a lot,"
Ricky had said when he came to fix the dishwasher Monday morning. The handyman Ricky now, not the man who had strutted down the street in a leather jacket. Nora should have minded her business. On the way home, she remembered a story Kathleen had once told during their lunch group about running into one of her high school nuns at the beach wearing a black bathing suit. A one-piece with a skirt, but still. Both the nun and Kathleen had been so embarrassed they'd pretended when school resumed that it had never happened. Nora had embarrassed that other Ricky, who was cool and loose, a swivel to his step, tight jeans and high-top sneakers. Ricky on her block didn't dress that way, didn't walk that way, didn't even talk that way. He was all business,
methodical and neat, or maybe that was just when he was on the job, the way his posture and clothes were different there. Nora remembered being at Charlie's firm's Christmas party and having one of the administrative assistants say that being married to Charlie must be a pleasure because he was so neat and organized. Nora had had to bite back a snort of incredulity. That Charlie apparently lived in the office with the big cherry desk, the matching credenza, the oatmeal-colored couch, the landscape on the wall. Perpetually messy Charlie lived in her house. Maybe it was the same with Ricky. No cap on the toothpaste, coffee cups with muddy dregs on the table, socks on the floor. Maybe that's the Ricky Nita knew. But the one who worked for Nora never left a tool out, always used a dustpan and brush when he was done with a repair, even though Charity always stood there frowning, waving the dustbuster and breathing hard. Now Nora had to add Ricky to the list of things going awry on the block. The ochre shadows under his brown-black eyes were darker and deeper, and he had the kind of graven marionette lines that many of the women Nora knew had had plumped by a dermatologist. He still said, "Good morning, Mrs.," whenever he saw her, but he'd lost his light. Usually when she gave him items the twins had outgrown, soccer shirts, picture books, passing them along for Ricky's own children, he turned them over in his scarred hands and smiled. Now? No. When she told Linda Lessman she had watched him being ticketed, Linda sighed. "Please don't ask me to fix the tickets," Linda said. "Of course not. But the poor guy, he'll go out of business if this keeps up." Nora stopped to talk to him while she was walking Homer, and he was leaving the Rizzoli's later that evening. The Rizzoli oven had apparently gone kaput, but Ricky had cleaned out the automatic pilot, and heat had returned to the stove. Homer sniffed Ricky's pants leg. Nora jerked him back, and Homer turned slowly and looked at her with reproach. The idea that he would ever urinate on a human leg was insulting.
"No problem, missus," Ricky said, shifting his tool bag. "He just smells my dog. I got a pit bull mix. Her name's Rosie."
"Rosie doesn't sound like a pit bull name," Nora said.
"Nah, she's real sweet. Pit bulls get a bad rap."
"His wife not doing so good," Charity said later, shaking her head, and when she saw the confusion on Nora's face, adding, "She got the cancer in the breast. They do."
Here she made a motion that Nora assumed was meant to mimic a scalpel. Nora couldn't help but remember the size of the breasts on the windowsill the day she'd brought the humidifier to the Bronx, or the fit Nita had thrown from her perch above them. It seemed unlikely she'd be a compliant patient. "Maybe I can help with the doctor," Nora said. "I know people on the board of the big cancer hospital." Charity shook her head, then burst out,
"Help get people off his back with the parking! Mr. Fix yelled at him, that stupid man across the street."
Even Charity was contemptuous of George.
"Mr. Nolan, too. He works so hard for everybody. Night, day, weekends. He missed church for Mr. Lessman."
There had not been such an outburst from Charity since Rachel had been denied the part of Dorothy in the school production of The Wizard of Oz. "The Good Witch has a beautiful costume," Nora had said, as her daughter sobbed into her side. And Charity had hollered,
"Not the biggest part. Not what was for Judy Gardner when she was in the movie."
Not for the first time, Nora wondered what would become of them if Charity were to quit. There were always rumors of poachers, newcomers to the high-rise buildings that had grown up around the block like a forbidding fence, women who trawled the parks and grocery stores for nannies and housekeepers who could be lured away with bigger salaries or lighter duties. Since part of Charity's routine, when she'd first started to work for them, was to believe that Oliver and Rachel were the most remarkable children to ever be born in a New York hospital, Nora had been confident for years that she would not leave. When she had first started to think about the twins leaving for college, she had found herself poised on a dark chasm of sadness and uncertainty, because she would miss them so terribly and because she was convinced Charity would quit.
"No way, Mom,"
Oliver said. "Homer," Rachel added. "Charity will stay until Homer dies."
"Don't say that,"
yelled Oliver. "Then she'll come work for me," Rachel continued. "Can you afford Charity?" Nora said.
"No, but you can," Rachel said with a smirk.
"And maybe by that time I can afford her myself. Homer's going to live for a long, long time.
And Charity will stay for us, anyhow,
Oliver added while he was attacking a plate of jerk chicken. One of the reasons Charity loved cooking for the kids was that Oliver consumed vast quantities, often as though he were killing as well as eating his food. He had been a picky eater as a child, confining himself largely to rice, Cheerios, and bananas, and Charity took credit for the change. She insisted that both her sisters, whose names were, of course, Faith and Hope, said that she was the best cook of the three, which was a way to brag without seeming as though she were the one bragging. Vance apparently agreed. Vance was the only son, the golden child of the family, whose night school college classes had culminated in a job juggling numbers in some city department. Vance's opinion on any topic from Middle East policy to the care of hardwood floors was invoked by Charity and considered the last best word on the subject. There seemed to be some concern that Vance had not yet found himself a woman, but there was also agreement that no woman, even the estimable Mavis Robertson, who played the organ at church, was truly worthy of his notice. At church, they apparently used Vance's full name, which was Perseverance, but Charity said he had thought that was too much to use at work.
That poor bastard, Charlie had said after eavesdropping on that conversation.
Can you please all back off of Ricky? Nora said that night to Charlie, at the end of a mostly silent Thai takeout dinner, occasioned, she knew, by what she now thought of as the Bob Harris situation. Charlie picked up his plate.
Do they work for us, these people, or is it the other way around? He said.
These people?
You know what I mean. We're paying for the spaces in the lot, and Ricky isn't. If he doesn't like it, I bet there are lots of other guys in this city who'd like the work. George says there's a guy who works on 74th Street who's cheaper and better.
Oh, not again. The last cheaper and better was the tree trimmer who butchered all the trees.
You just don't like George, Charlie said.
I don't like George. I do like Ricky.
This chicken satay isn't great, Charlie said, standing up to get another beer.
Important reminder. Only paid occupants of the lot may have the keys to the padlock that holds the chain in place. No duplicates of the key should be made under any circumstances. The chain must be in place at all times except when moving a car in or out of the lot. George.
There are sounds that a person never forgets. Charlie Nolan said he would always remember the sound of the earth falling onto the lid of his father's coffin, although Nora had secretly found it a somewhat soothing sound, like very heavy rain on a very solid roof. Ollie could close his eyes and remember the explosive sound of the first home run he'd ever hit in middle school at the field at Randall's Island. Rachel, the involuntary squeal that had come from her mouth when she'd opened a nondescript envelope and seen a check for $500 after she'd won an essay contest her junior year. Nora would never forget the high, querulous complaint she'd heard in the delivery room from her children. First Oliver, then Rachel, although Rachel had long ago insisted that Nora admit the two had cried simultaneously, and Nora had complied. And Charlie now even believed this was true because he'd heard it so many times, even though he had been there and knew otherwise. Afterward, Nora realized that the sound she'd heard that morning in December would fall into the same category for the rest of her life. Once heard, it could not be unheard. First, there was a percussive noise that she thought was a jackhammer, and then something different, something that sounded like big bags of sand falling from the upper story of a building onto a wet pavement. It wasn't until she got closer and the screaming started, screaming that went on and on and on, so that, like a child, she wanted to put her palms over her ears, that she realized the last had been the sound of Jack Fisk hitting Ricky in the side of the leg with a golf club.
Jesus Christ, Jack!
Charlie yelled as Nora sprinted down the block toward the lot. What exactly happened that day, chapter and verse, depended, of course, on who was telling the story. There were only three people who actually were there, Jack, Ricky, and Charlie. Naturally, George told everyone as he trolled the block all weekend long that he had been standing right there, had seen it all with his own eyes.
He stuck to that until the police wanted an official statement, and then it turned out he'd actually been taking the rescue pugs to the groomers to have their nails trimmed.
"Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Charlie, do something!" Nora yelled as she neared the entrance to the parking lot. She had just finished doing her long run, her Saturday morning through Central Park buying everything bagel on the way back run. Just under 7 miles, just under 90 minutes. Nora liked that feeling about halfway through, when a trickle of sweat ran between her shoulder blades beneath her insulated shirt, at the same point when she had lost all feeling in her nose because it was thoroughly frozen. Then the shivers, coming out of the bagel shop, and the slow lope home. On a shorter run, she had time to obsess about what the twins would do after graduation, about whether they would move away or move back in, about whether Jenny had not called back because she was irritated at Nora or away somewhere for work. It was always the latter. About where she and Charlie should go on vacation and whether she wanted to go on vacation with Charlie at all. But for some reason, the longer route eliminated obsession and pared her brain down to purely the motor part of the cortex. Sometimes she would get home and realize she could not remember a single part of the run, that she was like a self-driving car, following a prescribed route with no one behind the wheel. She had been in that sort of fugue state when the screaming started. By the time she got to her husband, Ricky was lying next to his van, the leg of his khaki green pants pitch black with blood, the knee at a peculiar angle that made Nora afraid she was going to be sick when she looked, then looked away. His screams had turned ragged and breathless, his face a terrible putty color. The golf club was on the ground next to him. Nora knelt. She wanted to put a hand on Ricky's foot, but she was afraid anything she did would make him jerk away and hurt himself still more, if that was even possible.
"I hear a siren," Charlie said.
"Did you call 911? Nora said, looking over her shoulder. She saw Jack Fisk bent over the curb with his back to her, his hands on his knees. "Jack, did you call 911?
Charlie shook his head.
"What did you do?" Nora screamed at Jack. "Are you insane? What did you do?"
From behind Jack, she saw Linda Lessman running out her front door and into the street, stopping at the curb opposite and looking up at the end of the block. Nora heard that terrible sound again in her head, the heavy thing hitting the softer thing hard, and she turned back toward Ricky, who was sobbing, tears making tracks down either side of his face.
"They're coming," she said. "They're coming."
The sirens were louder.
"You gonna lose that leg,"
one of the men looking down from an open window of the SRO.
"It's all messed up, man. You gonna lose that leg for sure."
"Get up, bun,"
Charlie said, his voice shaking. He bent down to pull her to her feet, and she saw the cherry lights strobing behind her from two patrol cars. Suddenly, there were men in uniforms all around them. Nora stepped back next to Jack, who was arguing with two of the cops.
"Calm down, sir,"
one of them said.
"Him!"
yelled the man from the SRO. And when Nora looked up at the window, she saw that at least five of the residents were standing, staring down.
"Police! He's the one who hit him! He hit him real hard!"
"Give me a minute to get you a goddamn business card!"
Jack was yelling at the cops. Charlie put a hand on Jack's upper arm, talking first to him and then to the two police officers standing in front of them. Their eyes narrowed. Linda and Nora had stepped back and were standing shoulder to shoulder, as though they were holding each other up.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph,"
Linda said, craning her neck to look toward Ricky.
"Should I go get Sherry? Where is she? She should be here."
Between the wintry air and all of them breathing hard, even the cops, the area around them was as foggy white as the train station in an old movie. An ambulance pulled up and two EMTs ran to Ricky. The one man at the window of the SRO kept repeating,
"He hit him! He hit him hard! Officer! Officer, it was assault with a deadly weapon!"
"Shut up, you moron!"
Jack shouted back.
"It was a goddamn golf club!"
The two cops, nearly as young as Nora's own children, tried to speak, and one laid a hand on Jack's arm. Jack wheeled, looking as though he was going to hit the young cop. Another police car came down the block fast.
"They letting him go!"
the SRO guy yelled, leaning out so the others at their windows could hear him.
"They letting him go because that guy got hit, because he's black, and the other guy, he's white and rich."
"He's not black,"
one yelled back.
He's Puerto Rican. You don't know he's Puerto Rican? Why, 'cause he's brown? He could be light black, like Lena Horne, or what's his name, the ball player?
He speaks Spanish, dude, said the other man, leaning so far out his window to eyeball the other, one floor up and two windows across, that Nora thought he might fall out.
That don't make him Puerto Rican, man. He could be from Mexico, or maybe Panama, one of those other places. Officer, yelled a third man. Officer!
What? The younger cop yelled back.
I was in Attica in 71.
Ah, Jesus, Benny, not the Attica thing again, one of the other SRO guys said.
Don't put your goddamn hands on me,
Jack suddenly yelled. And the next thing Nora knew, he was up against the patrol car, face against the window, the officers holding him flat and snapping on handcuffs. Linda grabbed Nora's hand and whispered, I'm going to go get Sherry. Don't leave. Don't let Charlie get in the middle of this. Don't let him say anything to the police.
They taking him now,
said the SRO guy, talking to the others.
White or no white, they taking him. He messed with the popo. He'll get off, man. You know he will. These people, man, they pay the cops off. They get lawyers. They get out. The working man, now he goes to Rikers. I was at Attica in 71. Shut up, Benny. You're too young for Attica. You're just a nut bar.
It was amazing how quickly it was all over. The ambulance backed down the street fast, an EMT visible through the lit window bending over a gurney, and the police cars followed, two with the back seat empty, and one with Jack bent over in the back. Nora could tell he was yelling even though she couldn't hear him. The cords on his neck looked like trusses holding his head up. Linda ran back toward Nora. There's no one answering the door at their house. I've got to go inside and sit down. Nora said. You didn't see his leg. I feel nauseous. Did you see what happened? Linda said. Nora shook her head. Charlie nodded. I'll make some calls and then come over to your house, Linda said. Nora looked down at her left hand. She was still holding the bagel, wrapped in white paper, but she had crushed it flat and her hand was slick with melted butter. Charlie's was the first version of the story Nora heard afterward. And then Jack's, via Sherry, who had been away at a professional conference and had to get on a train in Boston fast. Both of them went like this. Jack was scheduled to meet a client at his weekend house in Bedford. The client was important. Jack was running late. Ricky's van was parked in the entrance to the lot in its usual place, the one Ricky insisted put it far enough to one side so that anyone could get past it. The back half of the van just inside the lot line, the front half jutting onto the sidewalk. Jack had tried to ease past. The top of his side-view mirror became entangled with the bottom of one of Ricky's vans at a moment when Jack was looking at his other side-view mirror and stepping on the gas. Nora could see it, could hear it, that horrible sharp sound of the mirror being torn off, the horrible sharp sound Jack would make deep in his corded throat as it happened. Jack kept going until his car was in the street. Both his side-view mirror and the one on Ricky's van hanging from a tangle of colored wires. In a rage, he leapt out and opened the trunk of his car, where he kept his golf clubs, and took out his 3-iron. Apparently everyone agreed it was a 3-iron.
I tried to grab his arm, Charlie said,
which Nora knew was a foolhardy act when Jack Fisk was in a rage. Charlie's just lucky Jack didn't brain him, Sherry said afterward. What had sounded to Nora like a jackhammer was the sound of Jack hitting the side of the panel van with his 3-iron. Charlie said that was when the men from the SRO came to their windows and started yelling. Between that and the sound of the golf club hitting the van, Charlie insisted that no one heard Ricky yelling, "Stop, Mr. Fisk! Stop, please!" until Ricky was right behind him and had jumped at Jack to try to grab his arm. By then, the side of the panel van, once convex, was concave. Who knew what the truth was? Jack said Ricky ran right in front of him, that he hit him by accident when he only meant to hit the side of the van. Ricky told the police Jack wouldn't stop hitting him, which sounded not like an accident, but like assault, which was what the cops charged Jack with when they took him downtown.
Remember that time Jack told Ollie to be cooperative and polite if he was ever picked up by the cops? Charlie said. He should have followed his own advice.
Ricky's leg was fractured in two places, or three, or four.
depending on who was telling the story. Jack had spent the night in a holding cell downtown, had been released immediately to one of his law firm colleagues, was at Rikers, was at home, depending on who was telling the story. Nora spent the day shaking on and off, hearing that sound again in her head, now that she knew what it was and what it had done.
"It was an accident,"
said Charlie, on his second vodka, and Nora put a hand up and said, "Don't say that to me again. Don't."
"You are the only person who has been sensitive enough not to ask me a million questions," Sherry said, when Nora saw her at the corner 3 days later. "You and Alma." She sent over a pan of chicken tetrazzini, which was nice, although it did suggest that someone had died. Jack ate most of it. He hasn't left the house since it happened.
"He's taken off from work?"
"They put him on some sort of leave until, in the managing partner's words, this is all sorted out. It's only the second time they've done something like that. The other time was a partner who was accused of beating his wife. He never came back."
Nora was at a loss. Finally, she said, "Do you want to go get a pedicure?" It was all she could think of, what Rachel always said to her friends when they were feeling low. Nora felt foolish as soon as she'd said it.
Sherry smiled sadly. "It'll be all right. The good news is that there are enough Fisks in this city that it apparently hasn't occurred to any of my patients that I'm married to the assailant. At least, no one has dropped me yet."
Right after the police had pulled away, Charlie had gotten into Jack's car and backed it into his assigned space in the lot. Nora noticed that he had no trouble getting past Ricky's van, although she wondered if that was because the van was narrower, with the side bashed in and its side-view mirror hanging loose.
"Jesus Christ,"
Charlie had said, looking down at Jack's car keys and then putting them in his pocket.
"Should I leave a note for Sherry that I've got these?"
"Don't forget we have your keys," Nora said to Sherry. "I can bring them over."
"I don't need them," she said. "I've got mine, and as far as I'm concerned, the car can sit there and turn to rust. I hope I never see it again."
Her voice shook slightly, and she compressed her lips.
"Have you seen the tabloids?" she said.
Nora had. So had everyone else. There were only so many dead-end blocks in Manhattan, and everyone they knew the one the Nolans lived on. Jenny had called her. Every woman in the lunch group had called her. Even Bibi had phoned from Florida. Nora had been short with all of them except for Jenny, who knew that Nora was what she called block-friendly with Sherry Fisk, and had said,
"I'm just calling to say that when you feel like talking about this, I'm here. And if you never feel like talking about this, that's fine too."
"And that's why you're the world's best friend," said Nora, who didn't feel like talking about it. She certainly didn't intend to discuss it with a reporter, although there had surely been attempts. Nora was walking Homer after work, and a young man in a down jacket stooped to pet him.
"Cool-looking dog," he said. "I've never seen one with eyes like that."
"He's an Australian cattle dog," Nora said.
"And you're Nora Nolan," he said, "from the jewelry museum."
"Do we know each other?"
"No, I just recognized you from pictures. Can I talk to you for a minute? I'm doing a story on the golf club assault, and I understand you were there."
"And you seemed so nice," Nora said sadly, and she turned and took Homer back inside.
Naturally, when she looked out the window 15 minutes later, the reporter was talking to George.
"You are hateful," Nora said aloud.
Charlie and Nora had agreed not to tell the twins what had happened, which Nora realized indicated how naive they could be. When her phone showed Rachel calling at 8 a.m., Nora snatched it up so quickly that it slipped from her hand and into Homer's water bowl.
"No!"
Nora shrieked, fishing it out, shaking it off. Incredibly, it still worked, although by day's end it started to sputter and crackle like experimental music, and by the next morning died, despite an overnight in a bag of rice.
"I can't believe Mr. Fisk tried to kill Ricky!" Rachel screamed.
Both New York tabloids had featured the story prominently, and both sounded remarkably the same. Jack Fisk, whose real name apparently was Joshua, who knew, was a wealthy partner in a white shoe law firm. Ricky was a struggling neighborhood handyman who lived with his wife and two young sons in the Bronx. The assault took place on a dead-end block on the Upper West Side.
Several years before, one of the tabloids had done a story on dead-end blocks and had described theirs as so neighborly that on Halloween, candy was placed outside on the stoops for trick-or-treaters. Now, neighborly had become isolated, insular, circling the wagons, which was reporter speak for residents who won't talk to us. Jack was wealthy. Ricky was from one of the city's poorer neighborhoods. Neither characterization, Nora was certain, was exactly accurate.